I guess let me start with Coben left us a quote. Coben Shinogawa, our founder, kind of about why he was here and maybe why we're all here. And I heard this years ago, and it just really caught my eye. And he once said, the more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, it is all your responsibility. We face such a big task, so naturally we sit down for a while. And I think that kind of summed up in the simplest way, you know, why I came to Zen practice. I mean, I had all these reasons, but I just needed to sit the heck down. You know, I had all these thoughts going on in my head, and so I gradually wound up in a residential community. You know, I started practicing more and more, and then while I was there, I became a priest, and then it was all about that just makes the habit that Cliff is talking about is just every day a bell rings, we come here. After a while, you start out waking up every single morning at 5:30. And you're not going, oh, I don't want to get out of bed. You know, it was originally I didn't want to drive to the Zendo. And then it was like, I don't want to have to get out of bed. And so I'd wake up every morning, you know, and like, well, maybe I'm a little sick. Maybe not today. I'm tired. I got in bed late. But then after a while, you just hear these bells. And then the bell rings, you get up, the next thing you know, you're in the Zendo, and you notice you skip that whole part of, like, what's wrong with my life. And so community can really support you. And it's really just a wonderful gift. And then you're here, and you're living here every day, and you're doing this practice. And but your practice, if you live the outside, is not, you know, the saddest question out here in like large groups once in a while will say, can we really practice in without living in a monastery, without going to Japan, without going someplace else? And to me, that question is our practice is really pretty easy. We get these bells, we have each other. Nobody ever yells at you. There's no dogs or children walking up with their needs. There's, you know, at least while we're here, we have no employer that's going to fire us if we don't completely alter our lives right in this second. And so it's occurred to me our practice here is very easy and it's very beautiful, but your practice out there is challenging and probably what American Zen is all about. You know, and there's a couple people here from Japan, and Zen there is a very different kind of practice. It's a very different religion. You have there's monks. The monks meditate. The monks bring a sense of enlightenment to the community, and they're one kind of people. And the community is supports the monks. In America, having somebody else meditate for you, that idea just never caught on. You know that somebody could make a livelihood by becoming enlightened, and then their neighbors would pay them for this. You know, this concept is not, it's not, it's, yeah, not a lot, but here what happened when Suzuki and Coben and Mizumi and all these Japanese teachers came over, they learned very quickly that Americans want to meditate. They want to share in the gifts that meditation can bring. You know, and so very quickly, around the 50s, 60s, and 70s, all of a sudden you have this explosion of Zen practice. And so what Zen is in America is really an open question. And so you guys are kind of right at the cutting edge right now and learning how to practice, how to translate this monastic practice into your everyday life. And what are the bells? How does it equate? How do you reach a point where you wake up in the morning and you just get out of bed and you go to the cushion and you go to the day and you learn that maybe we don't have to yell so much. You know, maybe there's just not a need for it. You know, and maybe gradually I've found I've gained a sense of ease and lightness with the world that I never had before. And so the real challenge for me last year, or a year and a half ago, it's all of a sudden I was in transition. So I'm living in Sacramento, which is not an ideal Zen community. I used to call the Sacramento Valley the Great Zen Desert. But it was just me, and I lived with my uncle who owned a nightclub. And so I'm suddenly in the midst of this other life, and I've got to practice. And so I would wake up every morning, and I looked at Darren Little John has this term, and he wrote a book called The Power of Vow, which is, it's a 12-step book, but it's just a great idea of just sitting down and looking at what kind of a vow am I going to make. You know, how am I going to live my life here? And he talks a lot about neo-monasticism, which is a good term, I think, for what we're doing. We're kind of new monastics, or we're trying to live a semi-monastic life within the context of our everyday life. And the challenge for us is that nobody even knows we're doing it. You know, because if we don't want to become precious and say, oh, I'm practicing Zen, so you should talk to me like this, or you should do this. We've got to practice more of a kind of guerrilla Zen, you know, where we're out there sometimes hiding behind trees, but we're in the midst of a real life. So, yeah. Now, the good thing, and I'll touch it. Okay, I get a little. I came to this practice because everybody was facing the wall, and you never had to speak. And then, so far, it's not working out really great. So if I've got to collect myself now and then, I apologize. Okay. So when I got out of the monastery and I was living in the midst of a bunch of people in a nightclub who were working the nightclub business, what I did is I thought, for the first couple of months, you know, I'd try and get up in the morning and sit, and just gradually it just broke down because I really wasn't fully engaged in a new way. I was just trying to, you know, walk out, carry my practice, and just kind of hoping that my previous training would just carry me over into this world where it wasn't quite relevant. You know, and then I thought, well, where I'm living right now, well, I can't really do things because of where I'm living right now, or because of the work I'm doing, or because the conditions of my life that don't allow me to practice. And so that went on for a couple of months. And at the end of the couple of months, you know, I started getting depressed. I started getting angry. I started going through the same thing that happens to anybody that doesn't practice. So finally, fortunately, spring came. And I just noticed all this beauty. And I kind of remembered that the heart of my practice is when my mind gets quiet, I can see things, and suddenly I notice that things just get a little brighter and things are really beautiful. And so spring came along, and that beauty just got right in my face and kind of said, hey, do you remember your practice and your vows and all that stuff? So I had to translate them. And so what I did is I got a mala. This one here, I had a mala, I wasn't wearing it. It's so much, and the mala is really great. This is an old Buddhist, they're prayer beads, and it's got a couple of practical functions. And when we're dealing with the practical world, it really helps us if we can find practical tools. And this one's great because it works kind of like a rubber band. You know, it's like wearing, you know, if you're trying to start a new habit, or it's like I'm going to follow this path, it's good to have a rubber band around your hand every now and then. And you can even, when you do something, go totally off course, it's okay to just snap it a little bit. That's may not be the original tension, but it works. Also, this one has 27 beads. And when I find myself in a challenging situation, it's helpful to maybe take it off, and before I speak or say anything when I'm challenged, just take one breath, hit one bead, and take all the breaths and work my way around the mala while I listen and really listen or think about this situation and then put it back on. And usually by then I'm a lot more centered where I was. And then speak, and that is a tool I've found invaluable when I'm dealing with situations that are challenging. So I got up every morning, I made a decision, no matter what, I'm going to get up and sit. Now, I would wake up late, or somebody would knock on my door, my uncle would knock on my door and say, we got to get to work right now, you know, and all of a sudden I'm on his schedule, and I can't sit the full period, you know. And if y'all have children, spouses, you know, dogs, or, you know, an alarm clock that you have a dysfunctional relationship with like I do, you may not always have time. So what I did is I drug my mat, I put it right by the door. You know, I had this area where I kind of made a little altar that was nice, but then I wasn't doing so well, so I drug the mat right by the door to my room, and I just decided, no matter what, every morning, I'm not walking out of this house until I'm on that mat for 1 minute. So I always sat my 1 minute. So I kept that bookmark, and it created that place. And I sat through, I had some really rough periods, but I just got up in the morning, and even when I wasn't doing Zazen the way I wanted to, and even when my Zazen was like thinking about this and that, I just kept in mind that the best Zazen I ever do is the one that feels like it doesn't work, because it's the one where I sit down and I'm way off, I think I'm off the whole time, and I get up and I just notice, well, I'm better. You know, things are quieter actually when I stand up, even when they were sitting down. So I try to keep encouraged by that. I got this app called Daily Routine, and my phone became an important tool because within it, I found a way, and you can do this with an app, you can do this with a clock, whatever works. But what was really cool is it would ring a bell. I could program in events. So I planned my day out. So at this time, I'm going to do this or that. And you know, I'm going to take my shower. I'm going to have my routine. And pretty soon, my iPhone would just, in the middle of my day, anywhere I went, would just go ding, and it was shower time. And the shower was a practice for me. You know, there were lots of kind of bells in my life. Anytime I got near water, my hands would go together. The water was sacred, you know, and whatever the word sacred means for you, but I could bring myself completely to the sink or the shower or whatever. But for that moment, because I'm in this hectic life, I'm out. I'm in, I'm out. And I think lay practice is about making that transition. It's about being thrown completely off course, which is okay. and coming back, you know, it's like, I'm going to go to the bathroom right now. And then that's a moment of monastic practice in the bathroom that nobody can see you, you know, and then I can come out and I'm back out. Good for another 10 minutes, maybe an hour, and then I'm off again. But then, fortunately, you know, there's a lot of water in the world. So the bells would ring. There's a million ways to set that up. And then I started practicing Gorilla Zen. I realized that the entire world, whether they knew it or not, they're my Sangha. And I really missed my Sangha. But I learned that when I went to eat and I walked to the counter and I would pay for my food, I learned to walk in, and the first thing I said, I couldn't walk up and bow, but in America, what works real good is saying, before you say, I want this, you say, you can always say, hi, how are you? And then take that moment and listen. And you find that after a while, it kind of throws people off sometimes, but they tend to smile and they say, I'm fine. Sometimes they ask how you are. And then you order, and suddenly your whole order has a different flow. Then what they didn't know is there were katas or just prescribed movements. So when I took my wallet out, I just had a way to take my card out and hand it to them with respect. And I, you know, nobody noticed I was doing it consciously, but unconsciously, all of a sudden I'm practicing with my Sangha, you know, and there's this exchange of food, and bit by bit, I kind of created this Sangha of the uninitiated who had no idea they were doing Zen practice, but they just kind of fell into it. If you can bring yourself completely there, people have a tendency to just kind of fall into this beautiful practice, because it's not magic. It's just how we conduct ourselves, how we face every moment. And when we're completely in the moment, not an idea of being completely in the moment, but just we're just there as much as we can be. People connect with that somehow, and I don't know how it works. Got a bike, and I got my bike sent out from Austin, and I just rode it, and just having that 1 hour a day, which was mine, and there's a million, but I think finding something you can do that's repetitive, that's simple, that just goes on, you know, Michael Paints, Doug Diggs, you know, we all, if we can find something once a day to connect with, it's a repetitive, simple moment that we can, movement that we can gradually perfect. Yoga is wonderful, you know, just, that's good. And so that kind of worked for me, and I gradually went from being completely isolated to becoming the happiest I've ever been in my entire life. And it needed no one. I mean, it actually needed the entire world, but the world didn't know they were doing it with me. The world did not know they were bringing me happiness. And gradually they didn't. Before I practiced, you know, living residentially, I thought, oh, I'm the happiest I've ever been, and that was nice, but it required all these people to sustain me every day. And so in this lay practice, this real world practice, the kind of practice that you do, I actually found the greatest happiness I've ever found in my life. So where you are right now is exactly a perfect opportunity. It doesn't. The problem with the monastery is nobody ever challenges you, and you're always dependent on somebody agreeing to follow these rules. In your life, you can learn to move freely, see beauty, and bring practice in a way that's not possible anywhere else except in the world of problems. So I had more I was going to say, but I want to leave time for questions. I'll mention quickly some practices I learned that were very helpful. I think in America the greatest untapped opportunity for practice is traffic. It's the commute to work. I wouldn't miss that for the world. If you can get in the car, drive Zen, be challenged, and let the crazy people on the road shift from blocking them and getting angry to realize somebody is coming up behind you with a problem, and just stay still, maybe get out of their way, and maybe help them, you know, get by you quickly for whatever reason it is. It helps me a lot if I put my tongue on the roof of my mouth when I'm going around and I feel challenged. That's part of the posture, and that way I can maintain a piece of my zazen in any situation I'm in. And it also helps me shut up, which solves about 90% of the problems I find. maybe close with this, that one of the most wonderful things about Zen is that in Zen practice, the ideas, we're always concerned with whether we're doing it right. You know, and that always vexes me. But Dogen, our founder in Japan, wrote, in Buddha Dharma, practice and enlightenment are one and the same. Because it is the practice of enlightenment, a beginner's wholehearted practice of the way is exactly the totality of original enlightenment. And so what he's saying is when you're sitting zazen, when you're practicing, you're a Buddha. Now, it doesn't always feel like it, and I know when I'm in zazen, I'm pretty sure that I'm not a Buddha. I'm pretty sure that if you look at me in these robes and figure, oh, he must be really silent, it's not quite that way. It's quieter than when I came here. It's more beautiful, but you know, while the struggle gets quieter, it never goes away. But it helps me to remember that even though this part is not a Buddha, there's always some part of me that is. You know, my knees may or may not be doing good, but to connect with within me, something is going right. And a guy in a 12-step meeting I went to once kind of paraphrases in a way that's maybe a little more clear, and he was new to the practice, but he'd been going about a year and he had somehow been able to maintain a practice at home as a beginner. And his secret was, and it was Dogen's statement, although he didn't realize it, he said that he had read somewhere that even if you fake it, you get 50% of the benefits, so it's worth showing up every day. So, okay. So I'd be curious if y'all have any questions, what's going on in your life, and maybe we can talk about how do we get this practice going, where we are.
I just want to thank you for that wonderful talk, and can totally relate to the traffic and I'm the guy behind you probably.
Traveling down Interstate 5, where it's two lanes each way, convoys of trucks, you know, there's ways to peel out around so people that are going fast can pass you by.
when
I'm passing a truck on Friday, and some guy comes up hard on my tail.
Yeah.
It feels good to let the foot off the accelerator a little.
You're the guy.
So, on the one hand, you help people along.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a time to maybe meet them, too, in some fashion?
Meet them? Meeting? Conflict? Challenge them?
Yeah. Yeah, challenge them. Challenge some aspect of the moment with them.
Uh-huh.
And I found ways... And it gets interesting sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it, so far it's ended up pretty good.
I think it's, you know, it's both Zen again, so it's all about intention. So what's your intention in challenging them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what is it?
The skill of a teacher is knowing when a student is ready to be taught.
Is ready to talk?
Ready to be taught. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the car behind us can be taught. Sometimes. Definitely not, yeah.
You get out of the way, yeah, which I do most of the time.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. And just there have been numerous psychological studies done, and when you confront somebody with strong information that they're not ready for, that actually hardens their defenses and hardens the behavior. So... what do you want to create? I think Michael's got it exactly right.
This reminds me of, I think I mentioned this to you, or maybe you, Doug. I heard this from Steve Stuckey, the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, who just died a few days ago. he had a driving practice, and it had four aspects. It was mindfulness of the driver, so you're mindful, you're aware of your condition, of how you're doing physically and mentally,
mm-hmm.
and mindfulness of the road, the condition of the road, and it's very interesting that he, you know, systematized it this way. But he did a lot of driving too; he commuted a lot back and forth. I think he lived north of Greenbelt, so he'd commute into the city and. In the Green Cup. And mindfulness, so mindfulness of driver, mindfulness of the vehicle, how the vehicle was feeling, how its condition of the vehicle, mindfulness of the road, and mindfulness of other drivers, of the environment. You know, so there's four, he actually worked on this as a practice, like you were talking about. So he divided it into four mindfulnesses, which is, I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
I've been, occasionally, I don't remember it all the time, but occasionally I've tried to, practice out of it a bit when I try. Particularly on 101. I wanted to ask you, Joe, in the midst of an activity like you're working with your uncle or something like that, and you realize that you're unbalanced or unstable or there's some emotional production or there's some kind of cue that you're
things aren't going well. Yeah. Have you had a practice of kind of bringing yourself back or from that?
You mean, yeah. Yeah, I think when I'm in the midst of that, it really helps me to breathing helps, like being aware that I'm cavitating. You know, do we all know that? We're
cavitating.
We're like a propeller on a ship can kind of get out of balance, and it starts wobbling, and the whole ship is just wobbling. And that, I get that kind of feeling when I get off, like I'm just not functioning right. There may be something seriously wrong with the ship. And in those moments, I mean, my practice has been to focus on my breath, kind of. But that can be kind of difficult because the breath isn't always real cooperative with me. You know, I'll be emotional. So I'll put my tongue on the roof of my mouth. And then I know I'm there, and then try to just breathe a few breaths and to just
kind of come back. Right?
Yeah, and there's a feeling, and then my hands I found I have more difficult controlling what's going on inside my body, but I notice I can let go of tension in my hands, and that actually my body corresponds with what's going on in my hands. So I'll check my hands, let them go, and then try, and I notice when I'm upset, my movements are more straight lines, so I'll try to move in a more circular fashion, and just kind of do all that, and kind of get my breath to settle down a little bit. That's kind of, I mean, is that what you mean in the midst of, like, I can't get in too much detail.
I think it's interesting because everybody can, I think from their personal experience, can say they have coping mechanisms for dealing with stress or emotional excitement or something like that. But to actually remember your, to actually make that more than just avoiding a situation or avoiding a difficult situation, running away from it, or avoiding it, or kind of juicing it and making it even worse, you know, making it more stressful.
Yeah.
You know? I think everybody has, even whether they practice or not, they know that there's a way to come back, you know.
Yeah.
But I think with our practice life, we have this deliberateness, this intent, this kind of deliberateness of coming back.
Yeah. And for me, the mole really helps because, like, once in a while I'll look down and somebody will do something and I need to respond, and then I'll look down and it's like, oh crap, I'm a Zen practitioner. So I'm pretty limited in what I can do. You know, I can't do that. You know, I can't say what I wanted to say. Maybe not so much.
Yeah, I need a mala. But you said something interesting about when you're upset, you usually are off, you hit things directly, and so then you come from more, make it more rounded, or from the side.
Okay.
That's talk about that.
I just noticed that when I'm upset, that my emotions are straight line. They're just, and they're very grasping, very grabbing. And we talked, you know, and I heard all this about grasping and clinging and all that. And I just noticed a lot of tension. But I just noticed one day. I mean, I was a framer. I built houses. It's a very, you know, pronounced activity. But I just noticed one day I was just holding on to something. It's like I don't need to hold this too hard. In fact, like everything I hold too hard. And so this it's still an ongoing practice of trying to hold things with the least amount of effort. Because I notice that when I squeeze this, if you take your hand right now and squeeze it like that as hard as you can, do you feel something going on here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then if you relax it, mm-hmm. feel that lighten up?
Mm-hmm.
So that, then I'm like going, I'm just interacting with the world. I notice that everything is like I tended to just, you know, move things like that, get them out of the way, just grab, pull, push, interact, you know, just... And so I noticed that if I lightened my grip and looked at my motions, and rather than these straight line motions, but just kind of bring things out and then come back to the center, and then go, and then there's a moment of balance, and then there's another reaching out and grabbing and coming back to the center. That's a very calming practice I've found. For me, it's done probably more than anything else.
It's not only taking softer paths from point A to point B,
uh-huh.
but also limiting your speed sometimes when I'm at work and I need to get a drink of water or get coffee. The energy is just to make go, just to get there and get back. And what I do sometimes is just take shorter steps and just smell the coffee on the way back.
Yeah.
And just to feel each footstep make contact with the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And that 60 to 80 feet between the coffee or the water and my office can make a very big difference. And also, Suzuki Roshi talks about limiting your activity.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of what you said reminds me of that, like paying for something with a particular form that you chose
mm-hmm.
for that activity. And limiting your activity in that way, like providing a template for how you conduct yourself in that activity, as opposed to doing everything without form.
Uh-huh.
It's ironic because there's you by placing additional constraints, you actually find more freedom in that activity.
Yeah, I've really noticed that one of the benefits of this practice, we get kind of more in touch with our own metabolism, like we can feel it speed up and slow down as it happens, and so I've kind of noticed that I generally try to keep it capped. So when I'm making that coffee run or all that, and I feel like all of a sudden I can feel it kick up. And then it's like slow down. You know, I mean, for me, I'm pretty well hyperactive. And so there's a whole lot of just slow down. And I found that really, if I don't get it kicked up, you know, when it really gets going, that's when I get the resentments, you know, active or somebody did this. But when I keep it down, my practice is a lot easier. And I also notice it. Generally, monastic Zen people are late for everything, you know, but the reason why is because it's okay to be late. I'm not going to kick my metabolism above that. So that's, yeah, I mean, what you're saying is, you know, I found to be really helpful. Yeah.
That what you're talking about, bringing our practice to every moment, and this is the American way rather than, you know, the monastic way of having to be told
uh-huh.
to bring the practice up with a bell. So I just notice in sitting, trying so hard, just, you know, Michael told us, okay, this is the way.
Yeah.
So I'm working so hard to just do that, and I find myself making such an effort. And then you came around and just went, tap. And all of a sudden my body just relaxed, right? So easy. And I was present, as opposed to thinking about what I was doing right and trying to get my hands there and my back there and my hip. You know, so all that thought was taking me away from being here. And then that little touch. And then it was so easy. It wasn't such an effort. So I guess what my practice seems to be more oriented towards relaxing rather than having to be told how to relax. It's just sort of natural. Uh-huh. I forget that. And the little reminders of, you know, whether it's water or someone pushing, you know, from behind, it's very helpful. And we do that for each other all the time.
Yeah.
Just here, each other, watching each other. I'm just really grateful for all that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, it's a constant seeking the balance between form and freedom. You know, I mean, the real gift of the Japanese here is, you know, teaching us, you know, these very, creating these forms, these very regimented ways of doing things, and yet finding an expression and a freedom in them, you know, kind of working within those lines. And I've noticed, like sitting, I mean, I started out bolt upright, and I sat alone for like 14 years, and nobody, you know, and everything I read was this samurai stuff. You know, and it hurt. It hurt a lot. You know, but then settling into it. Now it's kind of like finding the form and then settling in and finding the form. And then when I go too far, then it's back here. And yeah, but life is like that. But also to have the freedom to write your own forms. And just imagine, what would be the most beautiful way to buy a taco? You know, and then say, that's how I'm going to buy a taco. And when the other person doesn't participate in it, I'm just going to stay with my form. You know, this is how I hand you the credit card. You know, I originally wanted to do this in Bao. That's a little, that freaks people out. But I can go, you know, I mean, there's, you know, I've got a little way for that.
Same for you.
So I guess we're done. I just want to say, if you're new here, if there's any way that we can help you, it helps. If you try and learn a new activity or make a change, if you do it on your own, you know, research says you have a 50% chance, just under, if you do it with any kind of help, any connection with another human being, you've got an 85% chance of keeping that after 90 days. So it's New Year's. If you want to get your resolutions going, anybody wearing these robes or these rocket suits have taken a vow to save all beings, and you're a being. So that means that they have to help you. Okay? So if there's anything we can do for you, that's great. If you're a resident here, would you raise your hand? Residents are also under that temporary same vow. So get their email addresses, stay in touch, and good luck. Because it's such a beautiful journey, and there's so many things to find along the way.